glories, all glories to Sri Sri Guru and Gauranga, glories to Srila Prabhupada, Namah Vishnu Paraya, Krishna Prasthaya, Bhutale, Srimad Bhaktivedanta, Swami Nitya Namini, Namaste, Saraswati Devi, Gauravani, Pachani, Nivashesha, Shunyavari, Pashat, Shri Sthani. So, today is the appearance day of Sri Varaha Avatar, and today is also the last day for more than a month of this course in Srimad Bhagavatam, which will be resumed again after Gaur Purnima. So I expect the conjunction of these two circumstances are the reason why less students have come, apparently. Maybe more will arrive, but which is unfortunate because our dear Kashyashwar Prabhu, he labored the entire night to produce this very wonderful graph. Well, I had asked him actually to do for the whole first canto, but he was just developing the system. So it goes through chapter 12, canto 1, chapter 12. We are on chapter 12 right now. And in a very easy to refer to manner, you're at a glance able to see two chapters at a time. Where the questions are, this is the verse line, like here in chapter 1, there are 23 verses, so you see 1 to 23 at the bottom. So what the questions are, they're numbered, and basically, in simple language, the questions are given, the verse is given, verse number, who is asking whom is given in the box. Then a line is drawn, an arrow is drawn, so that you can see in the chapter exactly where the question is to be found, whether in the beginning, middle, or end of the chapter. In addition, some verses you see are, if, I guess those who are sitting far away can't really see very well, but you'll take one of these copies at the end of the class. But in addition, we have also marked the important verses of each chapter with stars. So as Kashyashwar Prabhu said, if you're interested in learning these verses, then as you learn them, you can always fill in the star with red or something like that. You know, check them off. Know this one, know this one, know this one. So I must congratulate him. He literally labored the entire night, hasn't taken rest yet. He did take a bath. I saw him do that before he ran off to get these photocopied. So I'm sure after the class he will have a good rest, well deserved. So those who are enrolled students will be able to take advantage of this. Unfortunately, those who have not come, miss out unless they arrive later and see Kashyashwar Prabhu themselves. So this is a very nice way to close this part of our course. You have this very graphical overview and can see the skeleton of the course, which is the questions and answers of Srimad Bhagavatam. We have, in the process of experimenting how exactly we should run this course, we have, as I was saying the other day, sort of gone from one extreme to another. And sometimes the actual basis, the foundation, the purpose of the whole course has therefore been a little obscured. But this will bring everything back into focus, very clear focus. And from now on, now that Kashi has worked out the program, along just as your study, chapter by chapter study guides that you're receiving now include the important verses, you'll also get a nice graph of the chapter 2. So that will become a regular part of the course material. But now this is a look back, or a refresher. So Very, very valuable. I've never seen anything like this yet. And this was actually suggested by one of our students when we requested that you give us feedback. So I thought it was an excellent suggestion. So at the end of the class, please don't forget, if you're enrolled full-time or part-time, to... Will they be stapled? No? They won't be stapled together. You can do that to, if you, yourself, if you want. Yeah, you can spread them out in front of yourself when you get home. All right, then. So we're going to continue. And as I indicated last time, it's very doubtful that we will finish the end of all this material, but at least today we will certainly get through the questions and their answers, which is, of course, the essence of the whole course that we're giving. So resuming our reading of the study guide on page 4 in the middle, at an appropriate time, Maharaj Yudhisthira desired to perform the horse sacrifice so that he could free himself from the sinful reactions that he had incurred during the battle at Kurukshetra. So just as a comment, this sacrifice of animals is, of course, in Kali Yuga forbidden. But in earlier ages, in the Vedic culture, this was done. In particular, as you can see in the circumstance here, for relief of sin. So the king was regretting all the lives that had been lost in the great war of Kurukshetra. So to relieve himself of the sinful reactions of that war, a horse would be sacrificed. And you find in other religions, even today, that tradition is carried on. That's where we get the English expression scapegoat, because I believe in the Old Testament, God instructs the Israelites that they should make a sin sacrifice, taking one goat and killing it before the altar, and this way their sins for that year will be exculpated. I also believe when Muslims visit Mecca, there's also sacrifice of goat, I think, at some point, also for the relief of sins. But actually, the Vedas have forbidden this because, why? Because of, we do not have the kind of brahmanas that were on the earth in those days, that means in ages previous, Dwapara Yuga, 5,000 years ago and before. In those days, the brahmanas were expert in chanting the Vedic Shabda, Shabda Brahma, the spiritual sound. And so when the animal was killed, Vedic mantras were being chanted that would actually raise the soul of that animal, either to some higher heavenly planetary system, or even to liberation. Or sometimes Prabhupada would say, as a kind of experimental proof to demonstrate the power of the Vedic mantras, Prabhupada said, the soul and the body would be restored before everyone's eyes in certain sacrifices. The animal would be before everyone's eyes consumed in the sacrificial fire. And everyone would see the body of the animal be burnt up. But then the Brahmins would chant mantras, and the whole animal, because Prabhupada also mentions that an old animal would be chosen for the sacrifice. So the animal would come out of the fire as a result of the chanting of mantras, its youth restored. So, practically the entire, or let's say at least the most important aristocratic citizenry would be in attendance at such sacrifice. They would be held in a vast arena so thousands could see. And that would be proof positive because, you know, for ordinary people, seeing is believing. So for brahmanas, hearing is believing. Because brahmanas can penetrate the mystery of the Vedic sound and gain realization from it. And actually see, just like the Bhagavad Gita is a discussion of five tattvas, beginning with Ishvara. Ishvara means the Supreme Lord, the Jiva, the spirit soul, the Prakriti, material nature, the Kala, factor of time, and karma. These are five topics. And actually these are tattvas. Tattvas means they are realities. You see, we talk about God and we think nice thoughts about God. But do we actually see the reality of God in these talks? We say, Aham Brahmasmi, I am spirit soul. But do we actually realize through that utterance the soul as distinct from the body? We talk about material nature, the para and apara prakriti. Prakriti means nature. Para means there is a spiritual nature. Apara means there is a material nature. The material nature is a shadow of the spiritual nature. The whole material world is a shadow of the spiritual. We can talk about this, but how much do we actually perceive of it? And similarly, time. It is no exaggeration. Kala chakra. Time is a great wheel. And the clocks and the watches, at least the old-fashioned kind. Now we have digital. But the old-fashioned round clocks and watches are based on that original Kala Chakra, which you get an idea of when you see, if you're able to observe, the turning of the constellations. You have to observe over days, but you will notice that how these stars, even in the course of one night, they change their place. And throughout these seasons, they change. So this is these are symptoms of the great Kala Chakra, which is ultimately the Sudarshan Chakra, transcendental wheel weapon of the Lord. So, and then karma. Einstein had this proposed that this theory of a space-time worm, he called it. In other words, if you were to see at once, which is supposed to be the real seeing, the living entity, in true space-time, then you would see his entire existence from birth to death, and it would look sort of like a worm, in the sense that there would be a small beginning and a small end, and you know, it would thicken in the middle. We've also had pictures in ISKCON from birth to death, and you sort of see that same. So, in his conception of relativity theory, everyone, everything is a space-time worm, because you cannot really separate space and time, according to him. So karma, it's a conception of karma that the activities of one body are a whole, that actually result, they have a result as a next body, and a next body, and a next body. It's called the chain of karma. So do we see this? Do we see how this body is a result of the activities of a previous body? And as Prabhupada explained, right now in this body, we are generating our next body. Our next body is being subtly assembled by every activity we do in this body. Hopefully, we're all assembling spiritual bodies because we're only performing spiritual activities. But if material activities are going on, then we're creating another material body. That's in the future, you see. So Trikalagya, one with Trikalagya, can see karma in this way. Past, present, and future. So that's called, this is all Dibya Pratyaksha, divine perception. So, ordinary people don't have that. We can hear about these things, and if we're a little intelligent and a little pious of heart, we find them interesting. But it, you know, remains largely kind of abstract, intellectual, interesting ideas. So in the Vedic culture of old, the science was the science of Shabda Brahma, the science of spiritual sound. We have left over from, even in our Western culture, some echo of that, some memory of that in the idea of the magic word, abracadabra, you see, or something like that. And then some wonderful thing would, if a magician could say the word properly, then some wonderful thing would happen. So the Brahmins of old actually had that power. And it can be very scientifically explained today, because scientists have come to the point of admitting that ultimately you can take this gross matter, this which looks like solid brick, and if I bang my head against it, I'm going to feel the hardness and feel some pain in my head. But they can break it down to smaller and smaller bits until they come to molecules, and the molecules break down into atoms. And already atoms are beyond... We can actually, through very powerful optical microscopes with glass lenses, we can still see some of the larger molecules, because they're larger than the wave of light, the wavelength of light. But there's no atom that is larger than the wavelength of light. So all atoms are therefore invisible, not only to the naked eye, but to the eye that is even, the power has been increased by optics, glass optics. So therefore you have something called an electron microscope. Now the electron microscope may be a very interesting instrument in its own way. It was invented in the 1930s. We have our friend from Germany here, so a German scientist invented it. But an electron microscope is simply giving a linga, a representation of something. I once talked with a nuclear physicist about this, and he said, to be honest, we're not sure what we're seeing, because it's something that appears on a cathode ray, like a television, you see, a TV tube, CRT, cathode ray tube. And so electron microscope is using electromagnetic waves that are narrower than the wavelength of light, so they can hopefully pick up smaller objects. But because we can't see them, then they have to be interpreted as impressions appearing on a TV screen. So, you see, you've also seen King Kong on a TV screen, you've also seen Godzilla on a TV screen. It doesn't necessarily mean that these entities are real. And that's what this man was telling me. He's saying, you know, we scientists, he was an honest physicist, and he was saying, we scientists can speak so confidently about what we know, but in actual fact, you know, although we have a, he said, in our physics laboratory, we have a device that will show you on the screen a circular image, and you're told that's an atom. We don't really know that that is an atom. What we know is that's a circular image on a cathode ray tube that is somehow appearing there. So our seeing power has its limits. And anyway, so scientists, by their process of breaking things, then atoms break down. This is all, now we come into the realm of pure mathematics. Pure theoretical mathematics breaks atoms down to protons, neutrons, electrons. Finally, it all comes down to what they call virtual space, and the potential energy in virtual space, which is represented as waves. So this for scientists is pure theory. They don't know that this is true, but it's logical to them. And that's where you get the string theory from. I don't know. Devotees who are good devotees probably don't know anything about string theory. But it is an interesting theory, in that they visualize the ultimate reality to be something like strings. Strings that are actually extremely, extremely tiny, more tiny than we can imagine. And these are strings of energy that are vibrating, like these strings on a tempura vibrate. And then that vibration is manifesting the world as we perceive it, you see. So this is their speculation, but it's just interesting how they have traced everything back to vibration. And so the Bhagavatam, we have this phrase from Prabhupada, sound in ether. This is actually what it means. Because sound, it cannot mean that there's two types of sound. What is it? I've forgotten the Sanskrit terms. If Maharaj was here, he would know. Just slip by. Anahata is one. I think it's nada and anahata. Anyway, one sound is struck. Anahata, I believe, is the struck sound that you hear with the ear. Now that is also traveling through ether, but because you can hear it, means it's traveling through air. You see, the air is supported by the ether, and therefore it's audible because it's actually moving, as modern science knows, air molecules that bump into the mechanism of your ear, and that creates nerve impulses, etc., 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 and we can hear. But there is another sound, nada, which is not audible. And so this is the vibration, what scientists would call the vibration in virtual space. Virtual space means it's the space beyond space, just like virtual reality. You've heard of this term? That you put on a helmet, anyway, I don't want to get old, but you connect your senses to a computer through helmets and gloves and things, or a whole suit, they hope to. And then sense impressions are fed into your mind directly from a computer, so that you can find yourself in some room that actually doesn't exist externally. But as far as your perception are concerned, it's completely real. And you can even manipulate objects. So they've done this primitive. I've seen films showing very primitive versions of it. Very awkward. And I don't think they're going to get much beyond this. Maybe they will, but they've pretty much exhausted the technology. Anyway, there's this concept of virtual reality. So virtual space means the same thing. It's a space that's not the space that we experience, you know, the distance between you and me. It's a whole different concept of space. And this is actually the Akash, what we mean when we use the Sanskrit term Akash. Akash is not this space between us. This space is filled with some... Of course, everything is held within Akash. But Akash is dynamic. Akash is multidimensional. Akash is pretty much, even though it's considered a gross element in the Vedas, it's pretty much inconceivable to us. So quantum physics has some, also they've noticed in this virtual space, amazing things happen. Matter appears and disappears, and matter, two material things can be in, or one material thing can be in two places at the same time. And there are so many magical, mystical things in the microcosm, that means in the world of very small particles. So these are just indications of the power of sound, the power of this shabda, this nada brahman, this primeval vibration in the original space. And so the Brahmanas of old, they had mastery of this. And that means, since everything evolves out of Akash and Shabda, the air, the fire, the water, the ether, which means gaseous elements, radiant energy, liquid and solid matter, it all evolves out of Akash. Just like I think I was mentioning before, when there was some alarm Someone saw me taking a little black pill and was thinking maybe I was ingesting some sort of hallucinogenic substance. I don't know what they were thinking. It was a black pepper, peppercorn. Because the pepper, black pepper, has the quality of a kosh. So yogis, they know how to live just by taking black peppercorn, because evolving out of that, it's a very sharp taste, but evolving out of it is all nutrients, all foodstuffs, if one knows how to extract them. So anyway, the Brahmanas of old, they could do this. They could cause an animal to be restored, rejuvenated. And so demonstrating this science of Shabda before the whole populace would give everyone faith in Vedic knowledge, even though they didn't themselves understand it. Just like today, we see airplanes in the sky, we see rockets flying up, we see pictures apparently coming from the moon. We see so many wonderful things science has done, and then we're ready to accept everything they say. See, even though a lot of what they say is just pure speculation without any substance whatsoever. Like string theory, for example, it said in order to prove or disprove string theory, they'd have to build a cyclotron, so-called atom smasher. It's this device, this long, they have one in Switzerland. I think it goes around Lake Lucerne. It's huge. A tube of metal. And they rotate particles faster and faster and faster and faster and faster, particle beams. And then finally they smash them together, and then they have instruments that read what happens when the particles smash together. And this way they try to discover even smaller bits of matter. And this is a way to try to prove their theories. So they say in order to prove or disprove string theory, they'd have to build such a device, which I think would have to be a ring the size of the orbit of Earth around the Sun. So it'll take them a while, I think, before they build such a machine. But in the meantime, they're talking, you know, string theory is in the vogue, and if you're a physicist today and you want to be cool, then you accept string theory, although there's absolutely no proof for it. And that's science. That's modern science for you. So let us continue. Because the state treasury had become exhausted by the war, Lord Krishna advised the Pandavas to collect the gold that had formerly been left in the Himalayas after King Maruta's great sacrifice. In this way, Maharaj Yudhisthira was enabled to perform 3 Ashvamedha Yajnas under Lord Krishna's direction and for his satisfaction, and for his, meaning Krishna's, satisfaction alone. After the completion of the horse sacrifices, Lord Krishna remained in Hastinapur for a few months and then returned to Dwarka as previously described. So that means the chapter 11, Krishna's return to Dwarka, actually happens after what we're reading now. Nivesha, in the purport to verse 34, Srila Prabhupada comments thus upon King Yudhisthira's dedication to pious works. One should take lessons from the acts of Maharaj Yudhisthira. He was afraid of sins committed on the battlefield, and therefore he wanted to satisfy the supreme authority. This indicates that unintentional sins are also committed in our daily occupational discharge of duties. And to counteract even such unintentional crimes, one must perform sacrifices as they are recommended in the revealed scriptures. The Lord says in Bhagavad Gita, yagyartat karmano nyatra lokuyam karma bandana, that one must perform sacrifices recommended in the scriptures in order to get rid of commitments of all unauthorized work or even unintentional crimes which we are apt to commit. For example, there's what is called the pancha yajna, 5 kinds of sacrifices that in Vedic times of old householders were required to perform. And this was to relieve themselves of the reactions of their daily household labors. For instance, lighting the fire kills. Just think of lighting a gas stove, for example. You have a gas stove. So there are many, many, many living entities have gathered overnight in those holes and inside the you know, all around where the fire comes out. And then you light it up and they disappear. It's like Holocaust, you see. We don't even notice it, but in a flash, millions of lives have just been lost because we want to cook our chapati, you know, cook our breakfast pancakes or something, you see. And we just killed millions and countless living entities. So that's one example. So in olden days, householders used to have to perform 5 kinds of sacrifice throughout the day. Now, of course, there's only one sacrifice. We should chant Hare Krishna. So to continue, by doing so, in other words, by doing sacrifice, one shall be freed from all kinds of sins. And those who do not do so, but work for self-interest or sense gratification, have to undergo all tribulations accrued from committed sins. Therefore, the main purpose of performing sacrifice is to satisfy the Supreme Personality, Hari. It's interesting, Prabhupada uses the word Hari. Hari means he who takes away. So the Lord takes away the burden of our papa karma, means our sinful work. He is the one. He is the only one who can take that away. No one else can take that away. So therefore, sacrifices must be done for his pleasure. Otherwise, they'll not be successful. So therefore, all this demigod worship, one is just setting oneself up for big fall in the future, because the demigods can give temporary nice things, you see, nice results. It's like a business. You give them something, they give you something material. But in the end, all of the sins remain. And although by demigod worship or some other temporary form of piety, we can stave these sins off, for example, sooner or later they will accrue. And that is why there's this cycle of birth and death. Sometimes someone is in heaven, enjoying very nicely his punya karma, his pious activities. But this wheel of samsara doesn't stop, and he may later on find himself in hell, suffering. And then back on earth, performing deeds again, karmic deeds, and again going up to heaven or going to hell, round and round and round, circle of birth and death. The process of performing sacrifices may be different in terms of different times, places, and persons, but the aim of such sacrifices is one and the same at all times and all circumstances, that is, satisfaction of the Supreme Lord Hari. That is the way of pious life. So next, section 12.3, Nibriti, which is commentary written by myself. Question 16 of Srimad Bhagavatam is asked by Shaunaka of Sutta Goswami. It is about the glorious birth and death of Maharaj Parikshit. Shaunaka asks it in 2 parts. Question 16, part 1. How was the great Emperor Parikshit, who was a highly intelligent and great devotee, born in that womb? That is verse number 2 of this chapter. And then also in the same verse, question 16, part 2. How did his death take place? And what did he achieve after his death? So, section 12.3.1 of the Nibriti states, the first part of question 16 is specifically answered in verses 7 through 17. This answer is summarized philosophically, thus by Srila Prabhupada. It is said in the Brahma Sangita, chapter 5, that the Supreme Lord Govinda, by his one plenary portion, enters into the halo of the universe and distributes himself as Paramatma, or the Supersoul, not only within the heart of every living being, but also within every atom of the material elements. Thus the Lord is all-pervading by his inconceivable potency, and thus he entered the womb of Uttara to save his beloved devotee, Maharaj Parikshit. In Bhagavad Gita 9.31, the Lord assured everyone that his devotees are never to be vanquished. No one can kill a devotee of the Lord because he is protected by the Lord. And no one can save a person whom the Lord desires to kill. The Lord is all-powerful, and therefore he can both save and kill as he likes. He becomes visible to his devotees. He became visible to his devotee Maharaj Parikshit, even in that awkward position in the womb of his mother, in a shape just suitable for his vision. This is from the purport of verse number 9. Then next section of the commentary, as Sutta answers question 16, he relates a question, you see, in the course of answering this question of the sages about the king's birth and his death, then he mentions that during the birth ceremony of Maharaj Parikshit, Maharaj Yudhisthira asked the question to the Brahmanas. And this becomes question 17 of Srimad Bhagavatam. And it is answered within the answer to question 16. Why? Because question 17 is this. Will Parikshit become as saintly a king, as pious in his very name, and as famous and glorified in his achievements as others who appeared in this great royal family? And so my commentary is, the significance of question 17 is that the previous questions by the sages asked about Parikshit's... that in the previous question, that means question 16, part 1 and 2, the sages asked about Parikshit's birth and death, but here Maharaj Yudhisthira inserts a query about his life. So you understand this is actually... Question 16, asked by the sages, are about Maharaj Parikshit's birth and death. And in the course of answering that, Suta Goswami relates a question that Yudhisthira asked about the life, what happens in between the birth and death. And so that question is also answered in the course of answering 16. So there's actually two questions and one answer in this chapter. So, okay, we have some time. We can actually finish the main part of this. Yeah, we can finish the chapter itself. Verses 9 through 26 present a summary of King Parikshit's life in answer to question 17. That answer is philosophically summarized thus by Srila Prabhupada. In the line of royal succession in the family of Maharaj Yudhisthira, all the kings without exception were the wisest men of their times, and so also it is foretold about Maharaj Parikshit and his son Maharaj Janamejaya, who is yet to be born. Such wise kings can become chastisers of upstarts and uprooters of Kali, or quarrelsome elements. As will be clear in the chapters ahead, Maharaj Parikshit wanted to kill the personified Kali, who was attempting to kill a cow, the emblem of peace and religion. The symptoms of Kali are, 1, wine, 2, women. Now, that doesn't mean that the fact that we have women in the world means that it's Kali Yuga. But that when women become objects of advertisements and their bodies are shown in different stages of undress, and prostitution of all different sorts becomes very widespread. In other words, women become the lust object that is motivating the entire society, then that is a symptom of Kali Yuga. 3, gambling, and 4, slaughterhouses. Wise rulers of all states should take lessons from Maharaj Parikshit in how to maintain peace and morality by subduing the upstarts and quarrelsome people who indulge in wine, illicit connection with women, gambling, and meat eating supplied by regularly maintained slaughterhouses. In this age of Kali, regular license is issued for maintaining all of these different departments of quarrel, because that's the point. This is very, very important point. Kali means quarrel. He's the personality of fighting. And there's no doubt that we're in the age of Kali. Because, actually, I read a statistic that every year, in some part, different parts of the world, there are at least 50 wars fought. It means, maybe on a small scale, between... two little countries, up to big wars like the ongoing war. Not recent, it's still ongoing. The war in Iraq is the one that fills the news. But there are all kinds of wars going on in Africa, in Asia. So the average is about 50 every year. 50 wars break out in the world every year. So this is definitely the age of Kali. There's no doubt about it. And the reason there is so much quarrel, so much fighting, is because of these four sinful activities. These pollute the heart of the human being, increase his 6 enemies. We have actually 6 enemies. And they're not, Al-Qaeda or, the Nazis or whoever you may say, Ku Klux Klan. But the 6 enemies are lust, anger, greed, madness, delusion, envy. And they exist in ourselves. And if we commit these four kinds of sins, they become very, 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 very powerful. And they overtake our intelligence, overtake our mind, overtake our activities. And this is the result of, the result is this brutality in human society, inhuman violence against one another. And of course, it's starting with inhuman violence against lower creatures who should be protected by us. So, Prabhupada, yes. So how can they expect, in this age of Kali, regular license is issued for maintaining all these different departments of quarrel. Prabhupada is saying the government licenses these things. And in fact, if you look at society, you see these four things. These are considered high culture. A gambling casino, I mean, that's a place you go dressed up in tuxedo, and women in their nicest gowns with their pearls and diamonds and their hair all done up. That's how they dress to go to a casino place. And the casinos are like the ones in Las Vegas. I mean, you know, are like palaces. Like, you know, if we could build a temple, you know, our temple could look as good as one of those giant casinos in Las Vegas. We'd be doing pretty good. They have this one that looks like it's a reproduction of pyramids of ancient Egypt, the Sphinx, the temples of Egypt are all there, you know, just as they were, everything illuminated by wonderful lights. And meat eating restaurants, you see, fancy restaurants, illicit sex, so nightclubs, also in Las Vegas and in Paris and other places, but these two are very well known for these nightclubs that, which women come out and do different dances in different stages of undress and drinking, intoxication, you see, clubs. In London, they're exclusive clubs just for drinking. The gentlemen come. You have to be a member, you see. Then you can sit down and have whiskey and soda.
But how are you today, sir?
Oh, I'm feeling very well, thank you. More brandy, please.
This is high culture today. The state fathers, therefore, must follow the principles of becoming wiser by devotion to the Lord, by chastising the breaker of discipline, and by uprooting the symptoms of quarrel, as mentioned above. So this is the purport to verse 26 of chapter 12. The second part of question 16 regarding Parikshit's death is specifically answered in verses 27 and 28. That answer is philosophically summarized thus by Srila Prabhupada. Maharaj Parikshit, being especially attached to the Lord from the beginning of his body in the womb of his mother, was continuously under the shelter of the Lord, and the so-called warning of his death within 7 days from the date of the curse of the Brahmana's son was a boon to him, to enable him to prepare himself to go back home, back to Godhead. Since he was always protected by the Lord, he could have avoided the effect of such a curse by the grace of the Lord, but he did not take such undue advantage for nothing. Rather, he made the best use of a bad bargain. For 7 days continuously, he heard Srimad Bhagavatam from the right source, and thus he got shelter at the lotus feet of the Lord by that opportunity. So, now there's a parishishtam, or an appendix, and I just want to read one part of that, and the rest you can study on your own. This is a brief quotation from Sri Krishna Sandarbha about these two great souls who are soon to meet at the end of this first canto, Sri Maharaj Parikshit, whom this chapter is about, and Shukadeva Goswami, whose birth we've already heard about. So, Anucheta 55, text 1, Maharaj Parikshit and Sukadeva Goswami were both great devotees of the Lord. This is Jiva Goswami writing. They are described in the following verses, Srimad Bhagavatam 2, 3, 15, and 16. Maharaj Parikshit, the grandson of the Pandavas, was from his very childhood a great devotee of the Lord. Even while playing with dolls, he used to worship Lord Krishna by imitating the worship of the family deity. Sukadeva Goswami, the son of Vyasadeva, was also full in transcendental knowledge and was a great devotee of Lord Krishna, son of Vasudeva. So there must have been discussion of Lord Krishna, who is glorified by great philosophers and in the company of great devotees. Now, these were two verses just quoted. Now, Jiva Goswami now comments that the word cha also in this verse, cha means also in this verse, refers the reader to the description of Maharaj Parikshit and Sukadev Goswami as both equally exalted devotees of the Lord. We may also note that the word Vasudeva, used in the same verse, means Sri Krishna, the son of Maharaj Vasudeva. The words Satam Samagame and Uru Gayasya Gunodara indicate that although great devotees are generally engaged in glorifying the various forms of the Supreme Lord, Maharaj Parikshit and Sukadeva Goswami will converse specifically about the transcendental pastimes of Lord Krishna. And it's also remarkable that both of them, while within their mother's wombs, both of them had transcendental darshan of the Lord. Sukadeva Goswami, by hearing the words of Srimad Bhagavatam, then he awoke to Krishna consciousness and found purpose for taking birth and moving in this world. And similarly, Sukadeva Goswami, Maharaj Parikshit saw the supersoul while within the womb of his mother and had to endure the burning up of his body, showing his power as a Kshatriya child, and that body was restored by the Lord. So both of them, even while within the wombs of their mothers, were Krishna conscious, specifically Krishna conscious. That's what's important here. They were not just Narayan conscious. I shouldn't say just, sorry. That's Namo Narayana, Om Namo Bhagavate Narayanaya. But as mentioned by Jiva Goswami, often when great personalities, realized souls, devotees come together, then their talks will be like today. There will be discussion of Lord Varaha's appearance day. So that is all auspicious. But Varaha Dev is an expansion of the Adi Purusha, Sri Krishna. So when we discuss Krishna, then he is the Purna Bhagavan, the complete, whole, supreme personality of Godhead, from whom all other avatars, all other forms of God, even those that are worshipped in other, we say, other religions outside of the typical Vedic purview, those which accept the Vedic scriptures, but at least those monotheistic religions that believe in some supreme being, supreme ultimate Lord, and they have their own names for him. Even these are manifestations of the original personality of Godhead by his mercy. So when we come to the point of talking about Krishna, then all conceptions of Godhead are automatically included. So this is very, very auspicious that for us today, that these two great souls met as they did 5,000 years ago to discuss Srimad Bhagavatam. The fruit of their discussion is what we are meeting about here in this class. And devotees continue to this very day to be liberated from illusion, liberated from the darkness, particularly the darkness of this age, by the record in the form of Srimad Bhagavatam of the conversation between Sukadev and Parikshit. So, we have completed our class period today. I thank you very much, those of you who attended, for not forgetting us on this last day before our break. And again, don't leave without your summary. I guess this would be called technically an organogram. I think that's the proper fancy word for this type of presentation. Organogram. It shows the organization of the questions and answers, and also shows you where the important verses are graphically. Don't forget this for your own study of the first 12 chapters. We wanted to have the whole chapter, canto 1 of Srimad Bhagavatam in this form for you today, but as you can see, we're understaffed and we're overworked, and it just wasn't possible. But still, Kashyapa Prabhu did a Maha Yajna for you all in just preparing the first 12 chapters. So let's have a round of applause for him. Thank you very much. And another reminder, Tuesday of next week, 4 p.m. Yes, I have now at last discussed with Nitai Gauranga Prabhu, and he agrees, 4 p.m. to 5:30 p.m. our combined, the two of us together, teaching the tattva of psychology from mainly from Srimad Bhagavatam, at least from my side, and from his side he'll be bringing in other things from Western psychology also. So an hour and a half class every day from Monday, well, starting Tuesday actually, to allow for the boys to get back on Monday. So it'll start on Tuesday, but it will run Monday through Friday, 4 to 5:30 in the afternoon, until we'll just see how long it goes. We have at least 2 weeks before the parikram starts, and then there's also time reserved for seminars. So if we don't finish, and it's likely there's so much material that we won't, then we'll also go into that seminar time, those 5 days. There'll be a break for parikram. So we'll just see how it goes. And this class will be interesting. It will have a film, as promised, that you'll find fascinating, that will show in the first few days. And there's also something else that I'm preparing up top for those who are want to have an actual experience of, participate in a kind of puncturatric process of that is aimed at helping you to understand through symbol, color, activities, and explanation, some very deep concepts of our Vaishnava philosophy, particularly pertaining to psychology. So the yantra foundations are built, and today I will put the yantras out. I've already put the sign out. If you come for a visit, you'll see them. It will look like a very esoteric, and people will start to talk and say, what's going to happen over there? Some tantric ceremony or something? Let me assure you that this has nothing to do with astrology or tantra. I'm not going to be offering you some gems at the end that you should buy in order to increase your good luck with certain planets. I'm not going to tie any yantras to your body. I'm not going to tell you what's going to happen to you in the future, nor will I tell you anything about past lifetimes, nor even is this necessarily going to be an analysis of yourself, revealing your innermost dark secrets. Oh my God, how do you know this about me? Although you may find it pertinent to yourself, simply because it will be a revelation of how things work on a deeper level of consciousness. So then we may be able to see things that work within ourselves. But that's up to you to extract what you want. I'm not. Everything that we will be doing is simply a kind of, demonstrative teaching lesson. Demonstrative meaning teaching by demonstration or teaching by participation. Teaching by activity. Just like is done with children. When you want children to understand something that's maybe intellectually a little hard to grasp, then you can do it in a graphical manner. So that's the purpose of this. So please understand that there's nothing esoteric. Although we're using the word esoteric as a kind of a joke, it's a humorous thing, but there's nothing esoteric in the sense of magic or. If you want something like that, go to an astrologer. There's plenty of them around here, astrologers or palm readers or whatever. That's not what's going to happen there. But hopefully this will help you understand what is being presented in the psychology course. But I must say that this that we'll be doing up top will not be free, as the course will be free. We ask a donation for the school. And I'll be talking about that more next week, as we'll start, we'll make that, we call it the Jnana Yajna, because it'll take the form of a sacrifice, but a symbolic sacrifice, not involving fire. Mantras and yantras instead. So this Jnana Yajna will require a donation. We ask at least 21 US dollars, because this is been, this has cost me something to set up, and we do, this is, you see, although we don't charge anything for the courses, we do want to earn some money for the school, so this is, I believe, the more Brahminical way, that we offer this as an additional service to you, and we request a donation for it, of at least $21, and we do have people who have emailed me that they're flying in from overseas to give very sizable donations because they've heard about this and it's so esoteric. But as I said, it's not futurology or anything like that. I have to make that clear. It's not tantra. It's not black magic. Please don't get the wrong impression. All right, thank you very much. And I hope to see you on Tuesday at 4 o'clock. If you're interested in the course on psychology. Hare Krishna, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.